All right, so I'm going to really just give a sort of a historic introduction and touch on a few applications of the notion of the fitness landscape. And I'm an evolutionary biologist, and evolution is a historic field, so I will give a historic perspective. The entire notion of the fitness landscape comes from a sort of a throwaway talk that Sewell Wright gave. Well, he thought of it as a throwaway talk that he gave in 1932. He explained later that he was asked to, he had just written his 1931 opus. That was his sort of contribution to the synthesis between Darwin and Mendel, 50, 60 pages of algebra. And he was asked to present it in an understandable form to geneticists, i.e. with no math. And so that's what this talk was. This is actually, if you can read carefully, this is actually a Geography Society meeting of about the same interval, not actually from Ithaca, New York. But
you're too well dressed for geneticists.
for American geneticists.
Bruce actually remembers the meeting.
I think he's this guy's sleeping. So he just sort of speculated a little bit about the problem of evolution by natural selection in light of what was now understood about genetics. And so these are some choice sentences from that essay. He guesstimated that there may be as many as 1,000 genes in the genome and 10 allelomorphs. That's one of these is a pointer. This is a pointer. I recognize it. 10 allelomorphs, which is old school talk for alleles, and that gives rise to 10 to the 1,000th possible combinations. Of course, at the level of genes, there are many more than 10 alternatives, and the level of genes, there are many more than 1,000 in the typical genome, so the space is much larger, but he does observe that this is already a very large number. And he says, if we imagine the field, the space of all possible combinations, graded, evaluated with respect to fitness, what would it look like? And so, as I say, he appreciates that there are a lot of loci, and thus this space will be of very high dimension. He sketched these discrete multidimensional hypercubes, and then says, now let's project fitness over these, over the space of the dimensionality required by the organism. One possibility, he says, is that a particular combination gives maximum adaptation, and then as things move away in mutational space. Oh, let me make one more comment. Like all geneticists in those days, I suppose he was thinking about diploids, but somehow this is completely accessible to haploid-minded people like me and I suppose most of you. So plus is the wild type, and then this is a mutation at A, and this is the double mutant, and this is a mutation at A or B or C or D or E, and here are the double mutants, and here is the quintuple mutant. So perhaps he was thinking about dominant mutations. In any case, it's sort of interesting and historic note. One possibility, then, is as you move away from the wild type, which is here, things progressively deteriorate in a somewhat smooth way. But he reckons that, as he points out, even in two factors, two loci, possibility of multiple maxima exists, and he reckons that as the number of loci goes up, the certainty of multiple maxima grows with it. And this is actually one of the several points of sharpest contrast between his view of evolution and Fisher's view of evolution. Fisher felt that the fitness surface would be single peaked and that interactions would be of modest effect, There's, I think, actually, they were both pretty good mathematicians, and I think there's a pretty good quantitative reason why they saw things differently, because when he writes, he's thinking about adding more loci, and as you add more loci under almost every framework you can imagine, the probability of multiple maxima goes up. But Fisher was thinking about adding more alleles to individual loci, and in that circumstance, the probability of multiple loci, as I remember, goes down. Anyways, we can take it as certain there will be an enormous number of widely separated, I love this language, harmonious combinations. And so here then is the first picture, and the way to read this, he points out, you almost can't see this, but he says that high dimensional space we're somehow going to compress onto the plane, and we're going to sort of let go of the idea that adjacent points are really adjacent, or differ by single mutations. We need that in order to be able to draw it on a plane, and then this is a contour map. So here are some maxima, and here are some minima. And then the problem as he sees it is how will populations move from, well, easy for natural selection to get to the local maximum, how will it get to higher fitness maxima? I'm going to recast this quickly in modern terms and show you a little bit of data of my own. In modern terms, then, the way I think about it is, suppose we're interested in the evolution of the junior businessman from the ancestral necktie. And to make that happen, I'm going to take some liberties with Photoshop and first describe these phenotypic changes. So there's the acquisition of the head and then of the limbs and then of the torso. And then I'm going to remind you that there's a genetic system to this. So I've made three loci with two allelomorphs each. Lowercase h means no head, capital H means there's a head. Lowercase t means no torso, capital T means there's torso, and so on. And in the language modern language of genetics, nucleotide sequence space defines many mutationally equivalent trajectories. So you can get from the ancestral necktie to the evolved junior businessman by lots of different routes. The cartoonist chose the one in red, but it could as well go in any of a number of other alternative paths. And so the way to build this thing, and this really just recapitulates what Wright understood, it, Maynard Smith also kind of contributed importantly to this, is to assign a different dimension to each locus, each biallelic locus. There's a fairly uninteresting extensions for multiple alleles at a locus to accommodate that problem. And so one question that this framework readily admits, and this is a thing that I and lots of other people have thought about, is the question, are these mutational trajectories equivalent in the eyes of natural selection? So from the genetic point of view, they're interchangeable, but are they equivalent in the eyes of natural selection, or is natural selection constrained to move on only a subset of these trajectories? Now, I want to point out that framing things in terms of mutational trajectories implicitly makes a strong selection, weak mutation assumption. So you're going to get a little bit more population genetics next week, I think. But very briefly, there's a lot of theory, as most of you know, there's a lot of theory built up to describe how mutations traverse population frequency space. Mutation appears, now what happens? Does it survive drift? Does it increase in frequency? How quickly does it increase in frequency? What happens if there are competing mutations of population? The full problem is fairly challenging to handle. One way of making one simplifying assumption is the so-called strong selection weak mutation assumption, which says quantitatively that the population mutation rate is a lot less than one. And that means that in every generation, so mu is the per individual mutation rate per generation, so n times mu is the total population mutation rate, how many mutations appear in a generation, that this says that many fewer than one. At the same time, n times s, the selection coefficient acting on these mutations, is much bigger than one. That means that they are that their evolutionary fate is resolved very quickly. So this is a timescale separation technique. In English, each mutation is fixed or lost before the next mutation appears. Also in English, that means the population is generally monomorphic. So we can really think of the population as moving from here to here, and then to here, and then to here. Now, if you turn up the mutation rate, or equivalently reduce the strength of selection, these two processes run into each other in time, and then you have to think about the population as some kind of cloud. Maybe it starts from here, and then there are mutations to these two alternatives, and they're co-segregating. And who wins now is a non-trivial problem.
So are there any examples of pathogens where this condition would reasonably expect it to apply?
That's a fair question. I would argue that at the level of individual genes, even in pathogens.
Once you say the individual genes you're going to look at, then you're immediately throwing away all of the interactions between things on different loci.
Absolutely.
But you're going to talk about epiphases and,
that's right,
and landscape, so that seems a very dangerous.
Yeah, so fair question, Daniel. I mean, the short answer is your question is very fair. And at the end, I at the end of this talk and every talk lately, I've been saying there's a serious problem here, because in many organisms, not just pathogens, not just infectious disease evolution, this assumption doesn't obtain. In the data that we've developed working on mutations in a single gene, I would argue this is probably not a crazy idea. Moreover, I would argue that epistatic interactions, so Daniel is anticipating a really important point, which is if there's no epistasis, that is to say, if mutations act in a way that's, the mutational effect on an organism is independent of what other mutations there are, then you don't need a landscape at all. You can just evaluate each mutation on its merits, right? You can already see that the size of this problem is growing exponentially with the number of loci you consider, and that's in order to accommodate the most general case where every mutation's effect is completely dependent on what other mutations are there. But if you don't have epistasis, you don't need any of that. You can just look at a mutation, compute its know its fitness effect, and compute its fate. Okay. However, I would say, based less on data and more on intuition, that epistatic interactions between genes are weaker than they are within genes. And there's some sense of modularity, and that, I think, is one manifestation of the modularity in organisms, that the epistatic interactions between genes are likely to be weaker. The data aren't very good on that question.
So this is probably a rather important point that we should have some discussion on later.
Yeah, right.
Rather crucial.
Right, right. Maybe you can help us with that next week. Okay, so I want to say a little bit more about epistasis. With respect to populations traversing this network, assuming the strong selection weak mutation assumption, and asking this question, are these trajectories interchangeable or not, all that really matters is whether mutations are unconditionally beneficial. And to illustrate, which is a form of epistasis, mutations are unconditionally beneficial. That means they're beneficial on all backgrounds. By unconditionally, I mean unconditioned on genetic background. Mutations are unconditioned on genetic background means there's a constraint on the kind of epistasis in play. And I want to illustrate why, this is almost obvious, but illustrate why unconditionally beneficial mutations are the answer to the question, are all these trajectories interchangeable? So here what I'm going to do is focus on the T mutation, which is highlighted here in orange. And here I've made up some fitness values. I'm allowed to do it because it's my talk. On the x-axis, I've got the elitic state at the t-locus. On the y-axis, I have log fitness. And by taking the log, the slope of these lines, so these lines connect genotypes that differ only in their allelic state at the t-locus. And the slope of that line is the selection coefficient. And you see that two of the lines have a positive slope. One of them has a slope of 0. One of them is negative. So that the sign of the fitness effect is varying. This mutation in this toy example is only conditionally beneficial. And so natural selection will favor T only on the top two backgrounds and not on the bottom two backgrounds. And this is a form of epistasis, and it's a particular kind of form of epistasis that we call sign epistasis. The sign is what's varying epistatically. So you can look only at these two, and you observe that the slope is changing. That means the selection coefficient is changing. That means there's epistasis, but the thing is still beneficial. And so to a first approximation, natural selection will not be dramatically perturbed by that fact. We bring these check marks over to show you the mutations that are favored, and you can immediately see, if you couldn't already see, that in evolving from the ancestral necktie to the junior businessman, all trajectories that involve capturing the T mutation, either on this background, will not be favored by natural selection. Not to say there aren't other processes that will carry the population along those edges, but it won't be natural selection. So this gives you a sense of the intimate connection between epistasis and fitness landscapes. This notion of sign epistasis generalizes this very old problem of Sewell Wright's, is the fitness landscape multi-peaked? And you can see that fairly easily. Here I've shown you Sewell Wright's image again. And remember that what's going on, this is a function over a domain. And the domain is the space of all possible combinations of these mutations. And formally, we require that adjacent genotypes differ by a single mutation, and that we're going to associate a distinct dimension with each such locus. And so to see the connection between sign epistasis and multiple maxima, consider this mutation. So this is the same mutation. Why is it the same mutation? Because it's facing in the same direction. Every mutation gets its own orientation. Here, the mutation is beneficial because it carries you to a peak, and here it's deleterious, so it carries you away from a peak. This is the essence of the connection between sign epistasis and multiple maxima, but it runs only one way. So if you bring me a landscape of multiple maxima, I can show you the sign epistasis in your data, but if you bring me an example of sign epistasis, we can't be sure whether there's more than one maximum or not. So it sort of opens up the problem into a continuum from landscapes where there's only one maximum, and those are the first extreme that Sewell-Wright offered, to the other extreme, which is one like this. And in between, there are circumstances where some trajectories are limited, are inaccessible, but others are available. Okay, so here is an actual, what I would describe as an actual fitness landscape. This is one that we developed. This is, I pulled out all the slides introducing you to beta-lactamase because half the people in the room already work on the system. But these are five mutations that were described by someone else that jointly increase resistance in E. coli against the particular antibiotic about 100,000-fold. And so we built all combinations. And so here's each line is a different combination of mutations from none of them to all of them. And over here is the phenotype. There actually are clinical names for these things, a few of which I've shown you. And these are the data we measured, the drug resistance for each of them.
The first one is the regulatory mutation.
Did I say missense? I misspoke. The first one is not a missense mutation. It's upstream of the start codon. I once got my wrist slapped by an E. coli-ologist because it's not a regulatory mutation, because the regulatory regions are very well defined. And this, sorry, Bruce, I blew it. I once got my wrist slapped by the E. coli regulatory mafia because this is not in a well-defined regulatory region, but whatever, it increases expression by a factor of two, call it what you want.
Are most of the resistance mutations in either this gene or in this, what may or may not be the regulatory region?
You mean in the clinic?
Yeah, or in the lab. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very big question. There is a lot of beta-lactam resistance that's driven by mutations not in this gene at all. Methicillin is a beta-lactam. So MRSA has beta-lactam resistance, but if this is an enzyme that degrades the drug, methicillin resistance is a mutation in the protein binding, the penicillin binding protein that makes it slippery. And so the drug can't bind. There are efflux pumps, although Don told us that they don't contribute terribly much. I'm not an expert.
This is changing. What is the phenotype exactly?
This is Bruce's MIC.
But I guess you have the logistic curve, so you can look at the other parameters as well.
You totally could. Yeah. In fact, we have a machine like Bruce's. Our friend Tony Dean calls it a random number generator, but we like to think of it as a 96-well multi-label plate reader. We have growth rate data for every one of these alleles.
But yeah. You don't have the rest of the Hill function parameters.
We have not estimated them. Yeah.
So
That's a great idea. It should be done. We have the data. So anyways, I don't want to, I'm happy to talk about beta-lactamase evolution until your ears bleed, but I just wanted to give you this as an example of what I think of typically when I think of a fitness landscape. And so the essential components are that an enumeration of genotypes on the left-hand side, an enumeration of fitnesses, of phenotypes, fitness, or some proxy, some close proxy, and then a mapping. The table is the mapping that carries you from genotype.
But then there's the transition from MIC to fitness.
Fair point.
Which is a big transition.
A huge transition, yes. Yeah. So again, I mean, that's an interesting topic, and I don't want to cut off the conversation. You did a great job of kind of turning us on to some of those pitfalls. What we said in the paper was, if you're willing to buy that drug resistance is, that fitness is monotonic in drug resistance, then we can play ball.
I think, I mean, there's a bigger point here, which is, I mean, maybe we should, since you're talking about high dimensional things anyway,
yeah.
And we should agree that the second S of fitness is a plural, makes it a plural, and that it really is, you know, some high dimensional object of which this is one aspect of it in particular conditions. And somehow, it's an older discussion that has to be in the back of one's mind, or but not very far from the front.
Yes, absolutely. So your point is not simply that this is a column vector of fitnesses, but that I can evaluate this in 1,000 different environments that might be important.
But even in the one environment, there are already the Hill function and so on, right? So it's even in simple conditions, there is not just one number, right? And that's obviously in idealized conditions, you measure a particular thing in the experiment and you call it one number, but even with the same experiment, you can call different things, right?
Yeah.
So somehow, that always needs to be there, right? Because a lot of these aspects like peaks and so on in the landscape will depend upon which aspect of it you're doing,
right.
Even in one condition.
Right.
That really comes back to the point that, you know, fitness is just a construct in your mathematical model, and nobody really knows how to map it or anything in the real world.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in the lab.
Yeah, I agree completely. So you know, we were fortunate in this system to be able to sell the claim that this is, that these things are monotonic in fitness. I mean, I think it was actually the decomposition and the combinatorial decomposition that made the thing go. But yes, fitness is a profoundly complex quantity that subsumes all the biology of the organism. And so, you know, nevertheless, if you want to think about the fitness function, then that's the thing you'd like to have. And inferences you draw from proxies for that thing need to be suitably qualified. Okay? And then with these data, we were able to make this point. This is sort of parenthetical to the talk, but it does say something about drug resistance evolution. There are 120 ways of ordering these five mutations. That's 5 factorial. And only 18 of those 120 orderings have the property that drug resistance goes up at every step. So this, a lot of sign epistasis, you can see already. So the way to read this is the starting allele, the one with the sort of the wild type. And this is the quintuple mutant. And from here, there are 5 single point mutant neighbors, 5 single mutant neighbors, but only 2 of them have the property that drug resistance goes up. So this is a subset of that 5-dimensional object that Sewell Wright drew 85 years ago or whatever.
If you do an evolution experiment, do you actually see it take that trajectory?
Right, that's a good question. We've not done that experiment for a couple of reasons, but Arian has, so he may have something to add. The short answer is, I wouldn't expect to, because nobody told the bacteria it's only allowed to mutate these 5 positions. So, there are technical problems with beta-lactams that many of you know that have to do with sort of inoculum size effects, analogous to what Bruce showed for other antibiotics, where the MIC you get depends on the number of bacteria in the culture. So trying to do an actual evolution experiment, effectively managing the drug concentration in your experiment is challenging. Okay. Also, sort of parenthetically, we've gotten very interested in trying to think about quantifying higher order interactions among mutations. In these data sets, and in my data set and others, we have about 20 such data sets. We call them combinatorially complete. So notice that in this cartoon, I didn't call it out, but you see every binary number from 0 to 31. There are 2 to the L, where L is the number of mutations, combinations, 2, reflecting the fact there are only 2 alternatives. If there are more than that, then the problem gets even bigger. One of the serious limitations to this conceptual framework is, at least in some of its applications, including the ones that I've been employing, is that we require what we call combinatorially complete data, and that's clearly grossly impractical in anything bigger than a toy system. Nevertheless, we're really interested in some of the sort of statistical commonalities that are being seen among these data sets. Okay? So that's what I wanted to say about this first kind. Oh, let me just acknowledge some of the important limitations that I thought of yesterday, and then there are several others that have come from the floor. It can't trivially handle frequency-dependent selection. It can't trivially handle changing environment. It can't trivially handle dominance or diploids or recombination. It's quite stripped down. The problems, the experiments grow exponentially in the size of the problem. I just told you that. And it encourages us to assume populations are almost always genetically monomorphic, and that's not going to be the case. And so if you want to try to think about populations as being sort of swarms of clouds crawling over the surface, you're welcome to do that, but I'm not 100% sure that this formalism, that this picture, is going to help you make progress. Yep.
What's your problem with recombination?
Yeah. Well, you can... What I want to say.
So there's a fitness landscape, right? So how you move on it is...
you've already given up on locality.
Yes. Yeah.
Dimensional projection.
Yeah. So what this particular distance metric in the space buys you is a clear idea of what happens when mutation is the operator, When recombination is the operator, you jump around, things become more complicated. Mm-hmm. So it can be done. I mean, you can change that.
In the sense that the entire problem becomes less trivial, but the fitness landscape as such exists independent of
what's
complicated.
Yeah, okay. So maybe I should. This one here, I sort of wanted to acknowledge that that's not intrinsic to the conception either. It's just the way my mind tends to run. And similarly, my mind tends to struggle with thinking about how recombination.
I guess I'll disagree with Richard. I mean, in the asexual, at least you're sort of moving locally in some local sense in genome space.
Yep.
Well, with recombination, you're not even moving locally, so somehow even less makes sense. It's not true. In restricted context, asexual makes sense, but the recombination.
Well, but again, if recombination is very fast, then you really start doing gradient descent on the landscape. Still very useful. I mean, you can't. It's still useful.
If the sufficiently dependent.
But I don't entirely understand. So, what is the last bullet encourages us to assume population?
Well,
some of us are not particularly encouraged.
Yeah.
it's your assumption about the mutation frequency that.
I would say that as it's commonly deployed these days, this is an assumption which is restrictive, but
it's completely unrelated.
Yes,
to the notion of life.
That's correct. So as is your choice of how rigorous to be with recombination. So I agree, it's not intrinsic. This is not a limitation that's intrinsic to the conception, to the framework, any more than this is.
Yeah, it's sort of self-imposed, right?
It's self-imposed, yeah. Right. Okay,
everybody's free to look at this as recombination.
That's right. That's right.
There's a hierarchy, right? So there's always sort of, the first thing is to assume, is there mapping from geometric thickness? And then if you have frequency-dependent selection, then that's already out the window.
Mm-hmm.
With a changing environment, you could say, yeah, there is a mapping, but a change in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then if you have recombination, then I would say with mutations, there's still sort of a local neighborhood. And then you can even go to multiple guys in the population, that's still meaningful because they still make local moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you go to recombination, they make non-local moves and so on, right? So there's really sort of a whole hierarchy in this assumption.
Yeah, that's fair.
That break at different points.
Yep. Or break, or at least require more careful thought. Okay, I wanna, this is now kind of slipping back. Let's say two or three words about a similar conception of the fitness landscape that actually also derives from Sewell Wright, that I think has caused more trouble than I wish it had. And it's not a natural, perhaps for this audience, not a natural way to go, but I just want to point out that this exists in the literature. Wright and others sometimes instead projected population mean fitness over allele frequency space. So remember, formerly, the axes were, each axis was another mutation and the space was discrete, it's a hypercube. But Wright said, well, what if we fill the interstices between these points with, so now it's a continuous space, and at every point has a coordinate, which is a vector of real numbers or fractions, and those tell you the frequency of each of those mutations in the population. Right? Formerly, it was a statement about individual organisms. Now it's a statement about populations. And this came from Wright and was picked up on by several people. Here's an example of a frequency of chromosomal inversion in a grasshopper in Australia. Where fitness was measured for individuals. So each of these corners is a particular genotype, and then once you have their fitnesses, you can compute the fitness of the population as a function of the frequencies of those organisms in the population. And you get a continuous contour map like this. And so high fitness is here and here, and low fitness is here and here. And curiously, the population is found right at a saddle, which is interesting.
But then this is frequency dependent selection.
No,
this is just frequency in the population. It's all you do is say, well, if I know the fitness of little a little b, little a big b, big a little b, and big a big b, and I know their fitnesses, I just weight their fitnesses by frequency and get a population mean fitness.
But if this is not a plane, then don't you have frequency dependent selection?
No.
So there is no sense in which the fitness of an individual with a specific genotype depends on the composition of the population. It's just that the frequencies, mutations, are the relevant dynamical quantities in this case, and those are the ones that change. So, you know, and this picture is sensible at a limit where there's a lot of recombination.
Right.
Where individuals have pretty much no meaning in the long-term evolutionary dynamics, right? They're just sort of transient containers of alleles.
Right.
And so the dynamics of alleles and allele frequencies is basically determined by the average over the entire population. And this average changes as the allele frequencies change. Mm-hmm. That does not mean it's frequency dependent selection. Each individual still has a very specific fitness.
Yeah, it only means there's epistasis. If it's not a plane, it means there's epistasis.
In what sense is that the landscape that describes the dynamics? I don't understand.
Yeah, so that's what, let me just give a little bit of justification, then talk about limitations. We're not going to spend a lot of time here. The appeal to this is that it articulates with R.A. Fisher's fundamental theorem of natural selection, which says that the rate of increase in fitness is equal to the variance in fitness in the population. So this thing captures the variance in fitness, and the contours then reflect the change in the change in fitness. And so you can compute how quickly the population will move in every generation. So that's the appeal. And as Richard just said, it makes sense in the limit of lots of recombination where alleles are just traveling independently and the organisms are just jars carrying alleles and they're scrambled up every generation. But the problem is that, first of all, it disregards new mutation.
But you can put it in the problem.
I'm sorry?
So that is not a serious limitation.
That it disregards, yeah. This is a suitable way to model populations in the very short term. Right?
No. That's not a limitation.
Uh-huh.
And again, just as Richard was explaining, you know, as long as now you're in a fast recombination limit where individuals are some bags of alleles, right? I think that's Lewontin's term.
Uh-huh.
You just do everything in terms of frequencies. You can incorporate epistasis if you like.
Yeah.
And calculate correlations, right? So pair, frequencies of pairs and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a perfectly fine description, and you can a little bit more work at mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And describe both the short-term dynamics and the long-term dynamics. Right? Yeah, it's a more complicated problem, but there's nothing
intrinsic.
There's no intrinsic difficulty with defining the landscape.
Yeah.
But what? You're saying it's a Lyapunov function?
Yeah. Well, maybe we're. I think this is beginning to be a discussion for the afternoon.
I just want to point out the thing that we were struck by is that in the presence of epistasis and limited recombination, allele frequency is not dynamically sufficient. You have to know about the statistical association between alleles in the population in order to know what the population mean fitness will be. And so that's illustrated in this little, unfortunately, very fuzzy image. But what I've done here is to imagine this is two loci, allele frequencies going from 0 to 1 at one and at the other, and the fitnesses of the genotypes are the same in these two panels, but what's different is the statistical association between those two mutations. So here, they're completely randomized, and here there's complete linkage disequilibrium, so every time you see an allele, a particular allele at one locus, you're guaranteed to see the corresponding allele at the other locus. And the shape of the surface is obviously dramatically perturbed by that. So in the population where recombination is not, in this not, in away from the limit of infinite recombination rates, the shape of the surface can change as a consequence of recombination over time. And that's what I said here. I don't know why that image came out so fuzzy. It was, but anyways. So the last thing I want to say is to talk about a completely different conception of fitness landscapes that we encounter, and those are landscapes whose domain is not genotype, but phenotype. Phenotypic fitness landscapes projects fitness over organismal phenotype, And here, the appealing feature is that nonlinear mapping from phenotype to fitness gives rise to interesting epistatic effects at the level of fitness, even if you don't believe there are any epistatic effects at the level of individual phenotypes. And these have been employed quite a bit to theoretically yield and have yielded some nice results. So here is the grandfather of them all, Fisher's geometric model. I'm sure you've all seen this, but very quickly then, the axes correspond to different phenotypes. Trait 1 is the x-axis, trait 2 is the y-axis. We imagine some optimal combination of trait values. We call that the optimum, and then fitness drops as you move away from that. This is then some organism at position z, and here's a mutation, a beneficial mutation, because it moves the organism closer to the maximum. This figure illustrates the presence of epistasis, in fact, sign epistasis, in this system, because this mutation, so this mutation represents a change in phenotype, right? We've moved from here to here, and in starting from this background, it's beneficial, whereas here we have the exact same phenotypic vector, and we move away from the origin, so it's deleterious. Fisher used this model to argue that the probability that a mutation is beneficial, so starting here, we imagine mutations radiating in all directions, probably with equal probability. The shorter the vector, the more likely it is that the head of the vector will lie inside the circle, i.e., the smaller the phenotypic effect of a mutation, the greater the probability that it's beneficial. And there's been quite a bit of interest in this recently. This is just the number of citations that I pulled off of PubMed last night. And some of these results are actually quite elegant and satisfying. This is actually the Birch and Chow paper, which got me interested in microbial experimental evolution. That's one of those two, is the Birch and Chow paper that got me interested in experimental evolution, loads many years ago. This is another, just to illustrate that it doesn't have to be Fisher's geometric model, this is another model, a one-dimensional model from Darren Rakita and colleagues in the phage, PhiX174, or one of its neighbors. And the phenotype is on the x-axis. These are actually fitnesses of single and double mutants with a phantom phenotype that they imputed. And actually, it's been a while since I've read this paper, but the argument was in the discussion that they could explain this distribution of fitness values by assuming only a single phenotype, which itself exhibits no epistasis. So the phenotype of a double mutant is just the sum of the phenotypes of the two single mutants, but the fitnesses, this nonlinear function gives rise to epistasis. Okay, so that's the end of my crash course on fitness landscapes. We've seen three kinds. Discrete map from sequence-based organismal fitness is certainly the most common usage, but has its limitations. One sometimes in when you go to the museum of old papers, you sometimes find another conception, which is a continuous map from frequencies to population mean fitness, but it's not always dynamically sufficient. And then the continuous map from phenotype-based organismal fitness, which is largely agenetical, but has been used to good effect, particularly recently. That's all I wanted to say. Are there any further questions? Yes?
Phenotypes can well be binary, right? Or discrete.
So I'm sorry, phenotypes.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, it's a matter of what you're looking at, right?
So yep.
Not like phenotype to fitness is continuous, and it's more like you can do lots of things, right?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Is there any use of the continuous method, the allele in the population as a mean field-based theory?
I don't know. Yeah.
Because it can, you know, derived from that the fitness of a certain allele is influenced by the population, where the population is at that moment,
mm-hmm.
the time.
Yeah.
Even special.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Michael.
There's this last point that you mentioned, that you have sort of the epistasis at the fitness level,
yep.
and then you have possibly epistasis at the trait level. I think this gives rise to an interesting empirical question, namely that to some extent you can trade one for the other, maybe, because you can, as you pointed out, this is a sort of the latter one is the fitness epistasis is ubiquitous in these Fisher's geometrical model mm-hmm. and all these kind of things. whether the phenotype is linear, isn't that to some extent a matter of how we define it? Mm-hmm. Say, you know, if we take some examples where it's natural, like the binding energy of a transcription factor has often been argued to be linear, mm-hmm. and not have a lot of epistasis. Mm-hmm. But then in cases where we don't know so well how to define it, we could sort of, to some extent, try to trade these linearities, non-linearities, from one level to the other. So I wonder what this would mean for the empirical construction of such landscapes from data.
I don't have anything quick to offer. I can tell you, though, that just to amplify what you said, that the magnitude of epistasis depends, obviously, on the scale that you use, and that's true no matter what the trait is. So in our beta-lactamase data, for example, when we log transform the MIC, which is not a retarded thing to do because the measurement scale is exponential, much of the epistasis, though not the sign epistasis, but much of the epistasis disappears. I take your point formally, but I don't immediately see how to make progress, how to deploy that.
Bruce? Yeah, I just want, you know, the quantitative part is missing, but I just want to keep pointing people to the 10 beta lactamase evolution as a most wonderful example of adaptive. That, you know, every time you come up with a new beta lactam antibiotic, there's a whole shift in the 10 beta lactamases. And the guy whose papers you probably want to read is Tim Falskill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the most wonderful story of adaptive evolution, that every time you come up with a new drug, the enzyme modifies. You know, it's missing the quantitative thing, but mm-hmm. it is the qualitative there. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture of adaptive molecular evolution.
Yeah. You know. Thanks.
If you look at all 32 of those mutations that you've had for the beta lactamase,
yep.
How kind of different is the landscape than if you just kind of assign random numbers to each kind of node? I mean, does it have correlations? Is it
yes.
vaguely smooth, or is it just?
Yeah, no, it's vaguely smooth, which is on five loci. If you assign them at random, the odds that it's not. So I didn't call it out explicitly, but that image I showed demonstrates that the thing is single peaked. I didn't say it out loud, but there are no combinations of mutations from which there aren't single point mutations that improve the situation, except for the two couple mutants. That's exceedingly unlikely if you make random assignments.
If you look at have you done other systems, is there kind of a general rule that comes out of this, or?
Yeah, that's generally the case. But to be fair to the world, we have probably not done a terribly good job of sampling things very carefully. You know, we tend to look at a lot of work on enzymes, for example. We could talk about it offline. I have some nascent ideas without any data.
The comment
yep.
on the slides,
yep.
and going back to Michael's question about the fitness versus the trait, of course you can say the fitness itself is a trait, or any trait that's selected will at least artificially become fitness. And then so the issue is, you can define, you know, fitness landscape, right, on this hypercube by artificially constructing any arbitrary set of mutants and measuring it, right? But to the extent that, for example, you will look at the alleles isolated from the population, and especially the alleles relating to resistance and really strongly selected, you're not looking at any random set of alleles. And you can imagine that perhaps for some reason, selection prefers to bring to high frequency alleles that are additive.
Yeah.
Right? So you might expect to find different level of epistasis, whether you're looking at a set of alleles or a trait under selection, as opposed to any random trait that nobody cares about, right, where your set of alleles is essentially random.
Yeah, or in Arian's case, where they're deleterious. They're deleterious. I'm delirious. They're deleterious.
I'll show an example.
Yeah,
where you make this.
Yeah, that's a thing that we thought a little bit about. If you, so the experiment we've done is to draw a random landscape that has certain statistical properties, let evolution run across it, and then look at only the mutations it found and ask about the statistical properties of that subset.
So if you take what largely the conjecture that the evolution tends to bring up alleles in which the things are relatively additive, then you're immediately forced to the conclusion that they all have to be strongly environmentally dependent, those additive fitnesses, otherwise they would have all fixed in the population long ago.
Right.
And so it's sort of a trade-off of one complication for another one, both of which are important, and there's probably this sort of balance that comes up between those that is driven in general by the evolution, and hopefully which one might be able to say something about the general.
Okay, do you think we have coffee by now?
I told them that we'll be done a little earlier,
yeah.
So hopefully.
Yeah, so we're gonna take a break and maybe 20 minutes, reconvene. We'll reconvene at 20 minutes still. We'll start at 10:45.